The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
If everyone could settle in, we're going to start with our next panel. And we should be able to start the webcast for that second panel right now. Well, thank you, folks, for settling back in. I think it's fair to say that this first panel set a very, very high standard for both substance and expertise, but I have great confidence that our second panel will be able to meet that standard as well, because our moderator is not only a professor here at the Washington College of Law, but he's someone who has a very unique perspective, having worked inside the federal government, both as general counsel to the 9/11 Commission and also as associate attorney general. That's the number three position in the Department of Justice at the end of the Clinton administration. So I will turn you over without any further delay to Professor Dan Marcus, who will then take us into the next part of our program. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. I'm just going to, since we're running a little late, I'm just going to briefly introduce our panelists, and then we'll let them have at each other. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. Don Verrilli will be our first speaker. He's a guy with a pretty good resume. He was editor-in-chief of the Columbia Law Review, and then he clerked for Skelly Wright on the D.C. Circuit and Justice Brennan on the Supreme Court. I have a vague recollection, this is about 30 years ago, that we tried to recruit him unsuccessfully to our law firm, as probably a few other law firms did. But he went to Jenner and Block, where he had a sterling career and became one of the leading Supreme Court advocates in the private bar in the city. He's now joined the Obama administration and the Holder Justice Department as Associate Deputy Attorney General, doing states. He really is the point person, I think, on state secrets at the Justice Department, and so he's sort of the guy on the spot this morning. After Don, we're going to hear from two younger people. Don and I represent the older generation, and Sharon and Ben, the younger generation. I think of Sharon as the younger generation because among her many distinctions at law school, at Yale Law School, she was a classmate of my daughter's. Since then, she's been here in Washington and is now the senior counsel or something like that for the Constitution Project, which really has done a remarkable job over the last few years, both in written reports and panel discussions and all sorts of other things, in becoming a leading voice and a leading forum on national security and civil liberties issues. Our third speaker is Ben Wisner. After graduating from NYU Law School, I think, was a law clerk for Stephen Reinhardt on the Ninth Circuit, and then in a natural move for a Reinhardt law clerk, he went to work for the ACLU, where he's been ever since, and has been a leader of the ACLU's important litigation and other efforts in the national security area. He's been an advocate in a number of the state secret cases, and he will be doing a battle with Doug Letter, whom you just heard from on the previous panel, in the Jeppesen argument before the en banc Ninth Circuit in a couple of weeks. I told Ben, I think Ben ought to have as a point of personal privilege the ability to work in a little response to Doug into his remarks here. We're going to let Don go first and set forth where things stand, both procedurally and substantively, in the Obama administration's review of its policies and litigating positions on state secrets issues, and then we're going to let Sharon and Ben have at them.
Thank you, Dan, and it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be participating in the same panel with Sharon and Ben, who, as I'm sure all of you know, are two really terrific leaders in this area for positive reform in the law, and we at the Justice Department have benefited a great deal from their wisdom as we've tried to think through this process. I do want to add the same disclaimer that Doug Leder did to the prior panel, that I am an employee of the Justice Department, but I'm going to be speaking today in my personal capacity. I'll try to share with you as much as I can about the department's policies as I understand it and how we came to formulate them and what we think they mean and will do. Before I do that, I want to start with a digression, though, if I could. The question came up in at the end of the last panel about, well, will we confront a Pentagon Papers situation in the present or future? And I want to share this anecdote because I think it's relevant to this question of commitment to transparency. We did confront a modest version of that just a few weeks or months ago. Many of you are following the debate in Afghanistan about Afghanistan policy know that the Washington Post published virtually in toto a report by General McChrystal analyzing the situation on the ground. That report was leaked to the Washington Post as a classified document and actually posed precisely the question of whether the United States should seek an injunction to prevent publication of the classified document. As I'm sure you're all aware, the document was published without any such litigation. Anyway, now on to state secrets itself. The administration came into its authority in January with a commitment by the president that state secrets policy needed to be examined and reformed, and a commitment by the Attorney General that it needed to be examined and reformed. The first step in that process was the creation at DOJ of a task force of senior DOJ officials, career and management political appointees together. And we were asked by the Attorney General to review every pending case in which the state secrets privilege had been invoked, to analyze the propriety of the invocation of the privilege on the basis of the record, to ask ourselves whether the privilege could be invoked in a narrower manner than it had been invoked previously to allow cases to go forward, or at least parts of cases to go forward, and to glean whatever lessons we could from that review for policy change going forward. We undertook that review over many months, and the consequence of that review, I think, you know, to the great disappointment of many people in the room, was that we concluded that in the cases that we reviewed, that the evidentiary foundation that had been submitted to the court to justify the invocation of the privilege warranted the continued assertion of the privilege. We did that, I will tell you, with several people, myself included, approaching this with an extremely skeptical point of view at the outset. Nonetheless, after that review, came to those conclusions. We did make some modest modifications in our positions, one of which was in that Horn case that was discussed a little bit in the prior panel, where we, in fact, made a decision in that case that we ought to change our position from being one that supported dismissal of the case to one that supported allowing the case to go forward, but trying to limit inquiry into some sensitive information. The documents in that case were unsealed, by the way, at the suggestion of the United States. So that's why they're available. And so we went through this review, came to this conclusion about the cases, and the lessons we learned, I think, we can talk specifically about them and how they kind of manifest themselves in the new policies and procedures that the Attorney General announced in September. But I think it's useful to take a sort of step back and tell you at least how we were thinking about them after this review. That there, as we see it, there are really two kinds of problems that the use of a state secrets privilege presents. The first one is more in the nature of a lack of public confidence that the privilege is being used in appropriate cases and isn't being abused and expanded beyond the narrow range of cases in which it is appropriate. And that public confidence question could be addressed, could manifest itself in several ways. One, a sense that the standard of review that courts apply is way too deferential. Two, that courts routinely assume a posture of supine deference whenever the government comes in and makes and encants the word state secrets. Three, that we make jurisdictional arguments that aren't based on evidentiary submissions to try to get cases dismissed. You could go on. But this series of sort of what we think of as kind of public confidence issues. And then the second big set of issues is, as we saw them, were the cost to values of transparency and accountability in cases in which the litigation, because of the invocation of the privilege, can't proceed to a final judgment. And in that situation, a couple things happen. An individual plaintiff who might be aggrieved can't get a judicial vindication of the plaintiff's claims, and there's a broader public accountability function that can't occur, that would otherwise occur if the case could be litigated. Those costs are real and they're serious, and we acknowledge that they exist here. And the question for us is, well, what can we do to address that set of problems as well as the first? Now, in terms of the overall cost here, I do want to just try to put it in a little bit of context for you, not in any way to diminish the importance of this issue, because it's a very important issue to us, and we have spent, I can assure you, a staggeringly large amount of time working on it since late January of this year. One is, when we did this pending review of cases, that depending on how you count them up, there really are only about 20 pending cases in which the state secrets privilege, we inherited about 20 cases in which the state secrets privilege was invoked. Now, that's because a bunch of them have been consolidated, but the cases have been consolidated because they're essentially the same case. There are a whole lot of these surveillance cases, but a lot of them are just identical to each other. There's some variants, but they're identical to each other. When there are variants, we counted them separately. But the total was about 20. Of the 20, more than half were cases of the kind that Doug described as sort of your garden variety commercial dispute, two people fighting over intellectual property, with respect to some kind of a secret technology that's been licensed to the United States government. Mr. Nacho, the former CEO of Quest, tried to use state secrets-like arguments to prevent liability from being imposed on him for securities law violations. You know, a lot of that kind of stuff. But then there are the kinds of cases that I think are bringing us here today that have brought the attention on the privilege, and that those are essentially the surveillance cases and the rendition cases. Those cases are obviously of extreme importance, and they pose the issues in a sharp way where the costs are very high. So as we work this through, the conclusion we came to is that we thought that there were a number of steps that the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, the administration could take, and could take as an administrative matter, that could go a long way to addressing the first set of problems, what I had identified as the public confidence problems, and that we could do so in a manner that was consistent with protecting the very important national security interests that are at stake when we're talking about these cases. The second set of problems, the using the judicial system to achieve accountability, we came, I think, reluctantly and sadly to the conclusion that it was very difficult to accomplish meaningful direct change in a manner that was sufficiently protective of the national security interests. And our policy, and so we tried to address that in other ways, which I'll talk about, but our policy reflects that basic set of judgments. So with respect to the first, improving public confidence, Attorney General's policy sets some substantive standards and some internal procedural mechanisms, which are designed to ensure that the privilege is invoked only in rare situations and only when it's quite strongly justified. The first is that we have adopted, as an internal matter, a significant harm standard, that we will only invoke the privilege when we are convinced that the disclosure of the information at issue would pose a significant harm to national security. We did that in part because we thought that the Reynolds standard itself in court was one that was ambiguous and malleable and could be construed as a robust standard. It could be construed as a standard with no teeth at all. And so we wanted to try to articulate a standard that had teeth and hold ourselves to it. Second is that we have announced that we will apply in our analysis a principle of narrow tailoring, which means that we will assert the privilege or support assertion of the privilege in court only to the minimum extent necessary. We will do no more than we think we have to do to protect the national security interests at stake. What that means in operation is that in every case we will ask ourselves the question whether this is a case in which we can assert the privilege in a manner that allows the case to go forward, just fences off some category of information, whether we can delay assertion of the privilege to allow for non-privileged discovery to run its course before we decide that the privilege needs to be invoked, and whether there are other mechanisms we might use to avert the need to assert the privilege. So we'll conduct that analysis in every case and assert the privilege only to the narrowest extent we think necessary. The third is we make a formal commitment that we will not assert the privilege in order to cover up government wrongdoing or avoid embarrassment to government officials or institutions. Now, we've put a set of procedures in place in order to try to implement those substantive standards. Those procedures begin with a recommendation based on personal review of the underlying, a requirement that, you know, you have to remember that what happens here is that Doug and his colleagues are lawyers representing clients in these cases. And the clients are the CIA, the NSA, DOD, name your intelligence agency. And it is, in virtually all cases, the client that possesses the national security information, and the client that is saying to us at the Justice Department, we think disclosure of this information would compromise national security. So the first thing we do in this process is say to the client, basically, you got to prove that to us. The way you've got to do that is by giving us declarations, evidentiary material, what we need in order to satisfy ourselves that the significant harm standard is met. The Assistant Attorney General, whose division is handling the case, most often the civil division, but not exclusively, has got to examine that information personally, and on the basis of personal examination, make a recommendation that the privilege ought to be invoked. That recommendation then goes to a review committee. That review committee consists of senior Justice Department officials. They have got to personally study the factual basis for the assertion of the privilege and make a recommendation in turn to the Associate Attorney General, who's got to conduct the same personal review and sign his or her name, and then to the Deputy Attorney General, who's got to conduct the same personal review and sign his or her name, and then to the Attorney General, who's got to make the same personal review and sign his or her name. There's an extraordinary level of commitment within the department to putting the highest government officials in the department personally on the line for the judgment to make these decisions. And we want to do that because we recognize that these are decisions that should not be made lightly. They should only be made in rare cases, and they should be made only when the evidence warrants it. As I said, that set of substantive standards and that set of internal procedures is not a perfect solution. We think it will go a long way to reestablishing public confidence, and I will want to talk about that more in a minute. We realize it doesn't go very far to changing the status quo with respect to using judicial process to achieve accountability. For that reason, we have built in two other mechanisms that we hope will have an effect of improving accountability. It's not a perfect substitute. We don't claim it is, but we think it's a helpful step, two helpful steps. First is that the policy requires the Attorney General, in any case in which the Attorney General concludes that the privilege has to be invoked to protect national security, but also concludes that there are credible allegations of wrongdoing by government officials, to refer the matter for investigation to the Inspector General of the agency or department whose conduct is at issue. For those of you who have had government experience, you will know that these Inspector General investigations are real and serious and often have very serious consequences, including referrals for criminal prosecutions. So it is our hope that that, while not a perfect substitute, will be an important mechanism to accountability. The second is a commitment to congressional oversight, a willingness to participate in a robust oversight process that Will, as Professor Chesney was describing earlier, has historically, and we hope will in this process allow for an appropriate use of legislative power. So that's where we are. That's why we got to where we are. I will say just sort of the bottom line point for us here is that, and I'm sure this will come up more in the dialogue, but there was a lot of discussion in the last panel about, well, is this a jurisdictional defense or is it an evidentiary privilege? What is this thing and how should we think about it? And I think the right way to think about it is that it's neither one of those things. What we're committed to here, and as I Doug paraphrased the first page of our recent submission in Jeppesen, we're committed to the proposition that the courts have an important checking function to play here, that executive branch authority should be checked by judicial review. We embrace that concept. And second, we're committed to the proposition that the judicial function ought to be undertaken on the basis of evidentiary submissions that we make to the judge, and that we have got to provide to the judge an evidentiary submission that is strong enough and detailed enough and convincing enough that the judge can decide that our privilege invocation is warranted on the basis of the evidence we submit. And that is the basis of the argument we're making in Jeppesen. As Doug said, we said in that case that we recognize that Article III court has an essential independent obligation to review our assertion of the privilege, and that we invite the court to do so on the basis of the evidentiary submission we made in the record. Now, it's not, I'm sure to the disappointment of many here, including on this panel, a change in our bottom line position. It is an important change, we think, in the nature of the arguments that we are advancing in the policies that we embrace. We are not saying that as a jurisdictional matter, the subject matter of the Jeppesen case or the surveillance cases or any of these cases is off limits to any exercise of judicial authority. We are saying that the court has an important role to play and we have an important obligation to submit evidence that suffices to allow the court to play that role. So that's where we are.
Thank you, Don. Sharon?
Hi. I want to thank both Dan and Don for their kind words about the Constitution Project. But for those of you who are not familiar with our organization, we are an independent think tank based here in Washington, D.C. And we bring together political and policy and academic experts from across the political spectrum to work toward promoting various constitutional safeguards. And through our rule of law program, particularly focus on a lot of issues with national security and civil liberties implications, including, of course, the state secrets privilege. So our panel here today is supposed to talk about how the Obama administration's state secrets policy is different from the Bush administration's policy. And I would say that from the perspective of the Constitution Project, they have fortunately pulled back from the brink, but there's still a long way to go. And I want to talk a little bit about two broad principles, really, of reform that we think are critical here and that still need further development. First of all is the whole principle, of course, of checks and balances and reasserting the role of the courts to provide that critical independent check on the executive branch. And the second is a principle that a number of the panels have gone before me have talked about restoring the role of the privilege as an evidentiary doctrine and not an immunity doctrine. So just talking a little bit about the Attorney General's new policy introduced in September, I really want to commend Don Verrilli for his leadership in that and getting to that point, and I know that he has indeed put on a lot of time and effort into establishing that behind the scenes, getting that policy through. And I would say that this is a welcome development and has some positive changes, but it really is only the very first small step, and there are a lot of additional reforms that are still very much necessary in restoring the role of the courts. But three things I would commend them for in the new policy. One is the standard that Don described, talking about making sure that you only assert the privilege when it's expected that if there were disclosure of this information, it could be reasonably expected to cause significant harm to the national defense or foreign relations. And those terms of, you know, significant harm and reasonably expected are very similar to the terminology that is in both the House bill and the Senate bill now pending in Congress. So that standard, I think, is an appropriate one, and it's welcome that the Attorney General has announced that that is the standard that the executive branch will be applying at least internally in its deliberations. Second, I do think it's a great thing that they now have many levels of internal executive branch review before an assertion is made, culminating with the Attorney General, him or herself. And also the procedures that Don described for increased reporting to Congress and referrals to the inspectors general, I think are good and welcome developments. But I wanted to talk further about what still needs to be done. And first, just a sort of minor point, is that this policy coming from the Attorney General is just a policy coming from the Attorney General, is not binding on future administrations. So that is one key reason why legislation is needed. But even taking it at the present, if this policy is in place, we still do need much more, and coming from Congress but through the legislation, to assure that we do get an independent assessment and that independent check from the courts in these cases, and to reassert the role of this doctrine as an evidentiary doctrine and not an immunity doctrine. Now, Ben Weiser is going to be talking a lot more, I think, about the litigation since he is a litigator in this area, so I don't want to talk too much about that. But as you and there's been some discussion, Congressman Nadler described in detail the ongoing Jefferson Data Plan case, which we have the litigators on either side here as panelists. You know, that's an example, though, of a case that did predate this administration, but where they have not changed its policy, so that's that is being argued and coming before the Ninth Circuit. And under the new policy, there's been mention made of the Schubert case in the Northern District of California. And that case has been announced as coming through the new policy, being reviewed there, and yet the conclusion was that the state secrets privilege needed to be asserted. And the troubling thing from my perspective there is, once again, the Department of Justice is seeking dismissal of that case before discovery can go forward and without a thorough examination by the court as to whether there may indeed be enough evidence, non-privileged evidence, for the case to proceed. Now, there is an interesting nuance in how they're arguing it now, and you know, I sort of see this as good intentions evidence. In trying to pull back on the brink, although I'm not sure, in point of fact, whether it has any practical change or getting us where I think we need to go. Just I was looking at footnote 13 in the government's brief, where they say the court could indeed dismiss this case because the very subject matter of the case is a state secret. That's sort of the doctrine that we've all, many of us who've criticized the Bush administration's arguments and arguments that have come forward in the Ninth Circuit before have said, you know, how can you even say the very subject matter is a state secret? But they said it could be that. But to be clear, however, says footnote 13, the government does not seek dismissal merely on this basis, but seek summary judgment, and I'm going to paraphrase here, on the ground that the government's privilege assertions exclude the information they would need, the plaintiffs would need to go forward and establish their case and establish their standing and establish their case. So that sounds better, but it still is seeking dismissal before there has been discovery, before there has been an opportunity for the judge to review all the relevant evidence that's asserted to be privileged and make a determination, is there enough non-privileged evidence for this case to go forward and be litigated? So for these reasons, we really feel that the legislation, the State Secrets Protection Act bills that are pending in Congress, is very much needed to restore checks and balances in the role of the court, and also just critically to make sure that the executive branch is not left to police itself. The Attorney General's memorandum has great steps toward that, and I am a big believer in internal checks as well and the roles of the inspectors general, and I don't want to, you know, minimize those reforms, because I think those are all good. They're just not enough. And even a very well-meaning executive branch, everybody wanting to do the right thing, there are a lot of incentives toward secrecy, a lot. We know in the classification system that documents are classified that shouldn't be, that we have overclassification. We need that independent check. We need the courts to play that role and make sure that only what is indeed a state secret is being withheld from disclosure. And the other point I would make here is, even with this litigation, legislation, even if we get this legislative reform to try and restore the role of the courts, I fully expect that some of the cases are going to come out the same. And in each one of these cases where the government is making an assertion of the state's privilege, state secrets privilege, I expect that at least some evidence is indeed, at the end of the day, going to be found subject legitimately to the privilege. But what percent of the body of evidence for which they are asserting the privilege is legitimately subject to the privilege? And is there enough non-privileged evidence that the case can proceed? And that's really a decision that we need our courts to make and to figure out. And even if at the end of the day the decision is, no, there's not enough evidence, the case, the plaintiff is going to lose, the plaintiff can't establish his or her case, at least that plaintiff has had his or her day in court, we've followed the due process rights, and there's been a legitimate independent check on that determination. So I just want to highlight a few features of the pending bills that I think would go toward establishing that reform. I think Congressman Nadler already discussed some of them. Excuse me. But I just want to highlight a couple here. First of all, the legislation would codify this standard of review that Don really described and make sure that that is a standard going forward and is the standard being applied by the court. So we have that reasonable likelihood that there would be significant harm caused by the disclosure. Also, the legislation would require that the court conducts a hearing and that the government submits its evidence for an independent review by the judge. And here I just want to make a distinction between submitting a declaration, as detailed as it may be, and submitting the actual evidence. I haven't seen any of these declarations, so I can't speak to their sufficiency. I'm told they're very long and detailed, and I have no reason to discredit that. But there's a difference between having a judge, maybe with the aid of a special master, wade through evidence and documents and look at that and take the word of the high-level official that I've looked at it, it meets my standards. It may, but to get the kind of independent review, that kind of check on executive discretion, we need to have the judges actually looking at the evidence. Also, the bills would address this issue that we've talked about a little bit about the standard of deference, whether or not that ultimately at the end of the day is meaningful or not. There's been some debate about that. But it would make clear to the courts that this is, again, an independent assessment and would at least get rid of the utmost deference standard, which has been cited in some of the cases and which has been argued for on behalf of the executive branch. And there are provisions in both bills to specify that the testimony of government experts should be considered in the same manner as the testimony of other experts who may also have familiarity and expertise in national security issues, and that we shouldn't unfairly tip the scales just because somebody happens to presently work for the executive branch. You would look at that based on the facts and circumstances involved. Another point, of course, as we've been talking about already, is prohibiting dismissal at the pleading stage and requiring that we go through the discovery, have the judge make that assessment of whether there's enough non-privileged evidence for the case to go forward and be litigated. Also in that regard, there are provisions in the bill that require the determination as to whether there could be a non-privileged substitute for evidence. If you find the judge finds that the evidence at issue is indeed subject to the state secrets privilege, could we have a non-privileged substitute, maybe a redacted version or a summary, what have you, and that then the court would order that be produced instead. Finally, the legislation would have some specific guidance to courts on the tools that are available to them to help buttress them against just being a rubber stamp and to show them that there are procedures such as appointing a special master. They also have procedures for things like sampling of evidence. If there's an issue where the evidence at issue is very voluminous, that there could be sampling procedures used for the court to go through and figure out what's privileged and what isn't. So ultimately, I was at the Attorney General's new policy is a welcome development, but just a first step. And we really hope to see Congress take the next step, hopefully with the administration's support, to ensure that these new standards of review are codified and that we really will protect the role of the courts as an independent check on executive discretion.
Thank you, Sharon. Ben?
Thanks. Thanks, Dan. It's nice to be here with so many colleagues and fellow travelers and even adversaries, and I especially commend Don and Doug for showing up at a forum like this to take their licks. But I'm sure that they and you will understand that ultimately I'm much less interested in what they say at press conferences or at academic conferences than I am in what they submit to courts and say in their briefs. And there, I think, is where we part ways fundamentally. The topic of this panel is how or whether, I suppose, the Obama administration's litigation position has differed in state secrets cases. We can address that pretty quickly, as Don has conceded. In the particular cases, it hasn't differed. It's been pretty much identical, and in particular, in cases that allege grave executive lawbreaking by the intelligence agencies, the CIA and the NSA, when those agencies are the client, there's been no change whatsoever. The Obama administration, like the Bush administration, continues to effectively insist upon categorical immunity for alleged wrongdoing by those agencies and their contractors. The costs here are extremely high, and I don't think that we can measure the costs in the number of cases in which the state secrets privilege has been invoked, but we have to look at the kinds of cases and the nature of those cases. So that you have, in a case like Jepson, torture victims being denied their day in court solely on the basis of an affidavit submitted by their torturers. You have, in cases involving wiretapping, fundamental constitutional issues going to the heart of separation of powers remaining unadjudicated. And so near the end of 2009, we do not have a single decision from a federal court that considers the legality of the Bush administration's torture program. Think about that for a moment, because it's a different kind of cost. We have had not a single judicial opinion that rules on whether the Bush administration's torture and detention program was legal. And there is an ongoing public debate about that. And we don't have a single standing opinion from a federal court that adjudicated the legality of the Bush administration's disregard of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So I think the stakes here are extremely high. They go both to the denial of redress to the victims themselves and to the denial to this republic of having courts fulfill their traditional function of saying what the law is. I have argued for many years now, both in briefs and in public appearances, that the effect of the government's overbroad secrecy claims in these cases is to create sweeping immunity for the intelligence agencies in this country. I think that I'm now going to make a slightly more provocative statement than that and say that it is not simply the effect, but the intent of the government's use of the state secrets privilege here to create that sweeping immunity. And in my view, And granted, as Doug will say, I am litigating these cases with a blindfold because I don't know what is in General Hayden's self-serving affidavits to the court in these cases. But it's hard for me to believe that what is fundamentally at stake here is the executive branch's worry about secrets being disclosed to the public. I think that what is more fundamentally at stake is the expectation of the intelligence agencies that they will not be held legally accountable for actions that they were ordered to do by the political branches. In other words, the point of this exercise is to achieve exactly what has been achieved, which is to prevent any court anywhere from adjudicating the legality, the underlying legality, of the CIA's and the NSA's activities. Why do I think that? It's remarkable to me how unaffected the government's position has been by an extraordinarily different set of public circumstances, so that even since the case against Jepsen Data Plan has commenced, we've had the election of a new president. We have had executive orders that essentially prohibit the conduct that we allege happened here. They shut down the CIA's black site prisons where our clients were detained, prohibited the interrogation techniques to which our clients were subjected. We have had memoranda released to the public that declassify interrogation techniques that are far more secret and coercive than anything that was applied to our clients. We have had virtually every foreign government that we allege was involved in the Jepsen case come forward with its own investigation, some criminal cases, some civil cases, some parliamentary investigations. Some of our clients have actually received compensation from the very governments that assisted the CIA in their renditions. And even more fundamentally, the government's position in this litigation seems to be that our plaintiffs should not even be allowed to pursue this litigation based on their own evidence, without seeking anything from the government and without seeking anything from Jepsen, including a confirmation or a denial. And in that context, it's hard for me to believe that what's really at stake here is the risk of disclosing details. Because at bottom, what exactly can we disclose? I do not have a security clearance. Our plaintiffs are not in possession of any classified evidence. The only parties that arguably are in possession of classified evidence here are the defendant Jepsen and the intervener, the CIA, and they can surely ensure that they themselves don't release such classified evidence by invoking the privilege much more specifically and concretely rather than sweepingly and categorically. I do want to take the chance, if you'll indulge me, to respond to some of the comments that were made in the last panel.
You're indulged briefly.
Thank you. And then we'll open it up. Only, you know, I had a brief conversation with Doug Letter last week talking about the schedule, and I said, you know, there's a way in which if you read the government's briefs and you read my briefs in this case, we're describing two different universes that don't really intersect. They really are two different worlds that have their own logical coherence. If you read the government's brief, it's galling that we would even try to hold a government contractor accountable for this kind of conduct. And if you read ours, you know, the idea that torture victims could be denied their day in court, even on the basis of legitimate secrecy concerns, you know, seems beyond the pale. But I also think that not only do our briefs describe different universes, we actually read the Ninth Circuit's panel opinion quite differently. You know, I do not agree, for example, that the Ninth Circuit's decision in Jepsen prevents the government from asserting the state secrets privilege over evidence that is in the possession of private parties. And there isn't a single sentence in that opinion that so holds. And in fact, in this case, the government will, if the case goes forward, assert the privilege over evidence that Jepsen holds, and that is as it should be. Both Don and Doug referred to the government's submissions in the Jepsen case as evidentiary. And I take issue with that, because the government's submission in Jepsen is an affidavit written in 2007 by the former CIA director, who himself oversees the agency charged with serious wrongdoing here. And to me, that's not evidence. You know, to me, those are assertions that you know, do not have the same dignity as evidence. And I think that what we're really saying when we say that the state secrets privilege can be adjudicated at the outset, before the case has developed, is not only that the CIA director should assert what information is covered by the privilege, but that the CIA director and the court can know, before the case has even begun, what evidence the plaintiffs will need in order to make their case, or the defendants will need to assert a valid defense. And there, I think, the government's position demands a kind of judicial clairvoyance. It demands that judges decide before the parties have even had a chance to develop their legal theories, what is off limits for judicial review and to make a predictive judgment. And this is what the Ninth Circuit meant by hypothetical, about whether plaintiffs will or will not be able to prove their case without privileged evidence. And again, I go back to the fact that it's hard for me to square the government's position that this is about secrecy with their insistence that we should not even be allowed to try to make our case on the basis of evidence that is already in our possession. So again, I think that the stakes here are very high. I think that if we are going to allow the agencies that are charged with wrongdoing effectively to articulate the contours of their own immunity from suit, it is not just a major problem for the plaintiffs who are denied redress, but for our system of government. That's all I'm going to say for now, and I hope there are a lot of questions.
Thank you, Ben. I do want to leave some time for questions from the audience, but before that, I think we probably could benefit from a little more discussion from the panel. I'm going to give Mr. Verrilli an opportunity to respond to what Sharon and Ben have said, and I'll throw in a couple of requests of my own so that you can be comprehensive here. To the extent you can, could you give us some indication of what we can expect in terms of further statements of policy or positions on pending legislation in this area from the Justice Department? What do you think of one of the most important features of the proposed legislation is a SEPA-type of procedure to give courts another tool to try some of these cases that they haven't been able to try so far?
So, good questions. Let me start with legislation. The administration doesn't have a position in opposition or in support of Chairman Nadler's bill or the Senate bill now. We're engaged in a dialogue with respect to that legislation, but we don't have certainly not opposed to it, and we're certainly not endorsing the legislation as it came out of committee, but we're engaged in a dialogue on that, and it's been ongoing and it will continue. With respect to future statements from the administration, I think you will see a public report from us about the privilege review process, and that elaborates our thinking in more detail. I think you will also see reflected in our litigation positions the changes that will result from the policy judgments we've made. Sharon described them as a nuance, Ben described them as no difference at all. I think the reality is that there's significantly more than a nuance. We are affirmatively embracing the role that the courts play here, and we are affirmatively accepting an obligation to provide a sufficient evidentiary foundation. I think the real problem, and I'll try then to get to your other point, Dan, in answering this, I think the real issues here are a little different. This is not about whether the state secrets privilege is an immunity. It is not an immunity. I think, Ben's argument is that, well, it's effectively immunity. And I just don't think that's right or fair. The cases, if they're dismissed on the ground of the privilege, are dismissed without prejudice, so that if there were a way to try the case because information is declassified or becomes available through other routes, it's a dismissal without prejudice, just not an immunity. and it's also not conceptualized as an immunity in the way we are employing it. Our whole notion of trying to employ it as narrowly as we can is inconsistent with that. Nor is it right, though, that it's an evidentiary privilege alone. It is something that sounds sui generis and more complicated than that. And I think even Chairman Nadler's bill reflects this. It's about information, not about particular pieces of evidence, particular documents. There are some times when the information to which it applies will be a particular document, but there are some times when it will be a covert program or a sophisticated technology where it just doesn't, it's just not helpful to think about that as a question of what pieces of evidence as opposed to a declaration describing the program or describing the technology you put before a court. We have an obligation to provide the court with a factual basis for understanding what the national security risk is and how the litigation would put the national security at risk. And in order to do that, we've got to provide a lot of information about the program or about the technology. Now, Ben says, well, it's self-serving. It's done by the people whose conduct is being challenged. Those points are one way of describing the reality that is an ex parte proceeding. And that gets to your point, Dan, about the potential to use SEPA-like procedures. We've thought long and hard about that, and the idea would be to try to convert from an ex parte submission to an adversarial proceeding. And I think everybody involved in this process on whatever side is, you know, quite responsible in their advocacy. Those who want SEPA-like proceedings want to have still in-camera proceedings so the public doesn't see the information. And so, you know, we understand that. This is a good faith dispute. But as we weighed out the policy options, we came to the conclusion that it would be an unwise judgment to embrace those kinds of SEPA proceedings in this context for a couple of reasons. One goes to the risk of disclosure of classified information. And the other goes to something that was discussed at some length in the prior panel with which we agree, which is the risk that essentially what you're going to do is set up a different kind of court system from what our traditions would otherwise call for. We're going to have essentially a secret court in which very often the lawyers can't talk to their clients, in which the judge can't provide to the public the reasons for the decision the judge is rendering, and sometimes the judge can't even provide to the public the bottom line decision, because the bottom line decision could risk disclosing classified information. And that's troubling to us. And that's why we tried to seek out alternative mechanisms for accountability. But don't make any mistake about it. We understand that the costs are real. You know, if I were Ben, I'd be frustrated in the way he is. The costs are real here. We understand it. It's our responsibility to try to find the most effective way to balance those costs and those risks against the costs and risks to national security. And, you know, this is a process that's going to be ongoing. But it is not a process in which we are trying to assert an uncheckable executive prerogative here, either in theory or in substance. That's just not what this is about.
Well, can I respond a little bit? Yeah. I just want to elaborate on why I use the language that I use, and I use the word immunity, even though certainly doctrinally that is not the proper term to use. You know, I use it because the CIA's position in this litigation and all litigation in the torture cases is that it is the executive branch that has classification authority. Once information or evidence is classified, it cannot be used categorically in litigation. Which contractors the CIA does or does not work with categorically is classified. Which countries the CIA does or does not cooperate with categorically is classified. And so the result of you know, that sort of series of propositions is that any time there are allegations that the CIA has worked with contractors or with other countries to violate the U.S. Constitution or human rights at home or abroad in a program that the CIA director has determined is a classified program, there will be no recovery. And that position holds, I believe, regardless of how much public information there already is out there about the particular contractor. You know, the fact that we have evidence in the record that Jepson employees were openly discussing the torture flights that the company was engaged in, including high enough level officials of the company to constitute an admission. The fact that we have invoices, flight records, you know, other kinds of public documents that point very clearly to Jepson's role in these particular flights has no relevance because the CIA has determined that whether or not Jepson was a contractor is itself a classified fact and there can be no litigation. And so maybe immunity is the wrong word to use, but I'm still going to keep using it. I think, though, that I want to respond also to the point about secret courts, because I think it's a very troubling point, and it was made by the en banc majority in the very repellent Arar decision from a few weeks ago. And what Chief Judge Jacobs wrote in that case is, God forbid that we should have closed proceedings. That would be such an offense to our principles of open courts. And it's so offensive that therefore we shouldn't even recognize a cause of action. Better to have no cases at all than to have closed cases. And, you know, from the point of view of a litigant, I don't want to see closed cases. I would much rather see open cases. But let's look at what's happened in the Guantanamo habeas litigation in the last half a year. What's happened is that 40 of those petitions, those cases, have been adjudicated effectively behind closed doors. The public has not seen the government's evidence against the detainees at Guantanamo. We haven't even really seen their defenses. And yet those cases have been adjudicated, and 80 to 85% of the time the government has lost those cases because their evidence was weak. A closed proceeding is better than no proceeding when somebody's freedom is at stake, when somebody's ability to recover for torture, which is a very serious crime, is at stake. And when you have the other value, which is, you know, the ability to have any kind of adjudication of government illegality that will prevent it from happening again. So I don't think the fact that we would need, you know, very protective procedures that wouldn't look American is an argument for having these cases dismissed instead.
So just a couple of things about that. You know, accountability matters. And in the question of allegations of torture and accountability, you know, from obviously accountability in the context of a lawsuit like the Jepson lawsuit or similar lawsuit is real and important. But it is not the difference between accountability and no accountability. Remember that this president has forbidden the techniques at issue here. This administration has released the underlying documentation that the previous administration kept classified with respect to those techniques, further hoping to reinforce that this is not going to happen again. This administration has called for a prosecutor to investigate whether crimes were committed in the interrogation of detainees. And I can go on at great length here, and there has been substantial oversight by Congress, and there will be continuing to be substantial oversight by Congress. There have been multiple inspector general investigations, and there will be more. So it's, you know, it's a real cost, but it's not the difference between accountability and being scot-free. It's not the difference between accountability and immunity. It's a much more complicated question than that. Our answers may not be satisfactory to lots of you. I get that. But it's just not, that's kind of a black and white question.
Sure. I just want to speak a little bit more about this notion that you have to shut down the case at the outset. And, you know, Ben put it that the judge has to have clairvoyance about what evidence the plaintiffs will need. And I guess my point of view, I'm just not understanding the notion that the executive branch is asserting that we know you have to get into state secrets to litigate this, so we need to shut it down now, and why we can't go through discovery and have the protective procedures, have the in-camera review, and let the judge make that decision. I think some of Don's points about how this administration has released some previously confidential policies shows even people who work in this area may disagree. We need that independent check coming from the judge. We need the judge to be able to look at that evidence. And at the end of the day, sure, it may be that in a number of these cases, there will be a determination that it can't go forward, that there isn't enough non-privileged evidence. But why and how, in any kind of meaningful way, with real meaningful independent check authority, a judge can decide that before there's been a discovery request made is a problem I'm having with the continued litigation posture.
And no. I think one question that's connected to that is, although there is a nice statement on the first page of the Jepson brief that the court has to exercise its independent Article III authority, it's not clear to me what the government thinks that the court is supposed to do. Does the government concede that the court can determine that something that the government believes is classified is not a state secret? Or is the court bound by the executive branch's classification decision in these cases? And that's a very important question, because if the government's position is that the court can't override effectively the executive branch's classification authority in these cases, it doesn't matter what you call the review, there won't be any.
That's not right, Ben. It's just fundamentally not right. Here's the way it works. The court can decide whether the evidence we've submitted is sufficient to justify invocation of the state secrets privilege. If the court decides it isn't, then the government's faced with a tough choice. It's either got to turn that information over, or it's going to decide, nope, we're not going to turn that information over because we believe it's properly classified, at which time the court's going to be free to enter judgment against the government or impose any other sanctions it wants against the government. So it's just not right to say that by invoking the fact that information remains classified as a get-out-of-jail-free card, that's just not the way the world works. It's not. Now, it's one thing to say that the classifying agency maintains control over the classified information. They do. That's the law. They do. But that doesn't translate into an immunity, because if the court looks at it and says, yeah, it's classified, but this ain't no state secret, it doesn't meet the significant harm test or the Reynolds test or any other test, then the court, if the government decides it's not going to turn it over, the court has plenty of power to enter judgment against the government.
That so, answers my question.
So it's just not not an immunity.
It's interesting that Don mentioned the administration's actions in releasing the OLC memos that described in gory detail the interrogation techniques that were used against high-value detainees. Those memos were released over the objections of the CIA, which I assume argued that the release of those memos would cause substantial damage to the national security. And so I wonder whether any of the panel members want to comment on whether there's that action is consistent with the position that the administration has taken on in the state secret litigation.
Well, the only thing I'll say about that, Dan, is that the exact same human beings have made both decisions. And so the exact same human beings are engaged in a weighing process here and trying to make judgments about when they think the claims within the government that there is a risk to national security are strong enough to warrant the cost of transparency and when they aren't. And, you know, we're just doing our best to make those judgments, recognizing that there are really weighty values here and that that both sides of the scale got a lot of weight to them.
Now, the only other observation I want to take the prerogative of making is that, to me, the terrorist surveillance program cases, the NSA program cases, really raise most exquisitely the dilemmas of the state secret privilege, because the position taken by the Justice Department in those cases was preventing the litigation and succeeded in the courts in preventing courts from determining the legality of this stunning, massive program
that raise the most serious constitutional issues, not only under the Fourth Amendment, but under whether the president was had authority to do what he had done under separation of powers doctrine in light of the FISA legislation. In a way, and I guess you could argue it either way, Congress came to the rescue and passed legislation in effect making the program legal prospectively. But if that hadn't happened, I think you would be seeing even greater pressure on the state secret privilege today than you do now. Okay, should we throw it open to questions?
Why not?
Yeah. If you could identify yourself. I know your stomachs are rumbling. So we'll take about 10 minutes of questions and just run a little over here.
Hi, I'm Liza Goiting from the Brennan Center, and my question is for Don. First of all, thank you for coming. And I want to get back to the question Sharon asked you, which is, what is the harm if the assertion is, we know that you're going to bump up inevitably against privileged evidence, so we should just stop now? What's the harm in going through discovery and having the court look ex parte, in camera, at the evidence that would be responsive to the discovery request so that the plaintiff doesn't even know what that evidence is, and having the court look at that evidence and decide whether there's enough non-privileged evidence to go forward? And let me just say before you answer that I think if it's just about wasting time, then I'm not impressed. I mean, I think it's worth...
I won't use that as a reason.
if 1% of the time the government's prediction turns out to be wrong, and I suspect it would be a lot more than 1%, it's worth it to go through that exercise. And second, if the issue is national security, then I'm just confused, because I think if you're talking about just presenting the evidence to the judge, not to the other side, as far as I know, historically, there's never been a leak of classified information from chambers. So I don't see what the national security problem would be. So I'd be very interested in hearing what the harm is in testing these predictions.
Well, first, it's our policy that we're only going to invoke at the threshold in litigation when we think it's essential, that it is our hope that there will be a lot of cases when it isn't essential and we can allow the case to proceed. The times when I think it's a combination of two points. The first one is that because this is, this gets back to this sort of fundamental conceptual question about whether we're talking about an evidentiary privilege, something that goes to, is this particular document in or out? Is this particular deposition question off limits, or is it okay? That's really not the essence of what this is at issue in these cases. What's at issue in these cases is whether you can litigate about a program or an activity. And so the reason I think that we think that there are cases when it is appropriate to make the decision at the outset of the case. Now, to make it at the outset of the case on the basis of a very robust evidentiary submission that the judge will evaluate in camera, but that will evaluate in camera at the outset of the case, is that there are cases in which we can persuasively explain that there is simply no way for us as the United States to defend ourselves from this allegation without revealing myriad details about a highly sensitive activity, the disclosure of which would compromise national security. Now, there'll be a lot of cases where we can't make that demonstration and we won't try to assert the privilege at the outset, but in the cases where we think we can, we think that, you see no harm, but for me, it's, if there's a brick wall out there and we can convince a judge to a high degree of certitude that we're going to run into that brick wall, then there is a risk in allowing the discovery to go forward, because there is, as Doug said earlier, a risk that information will get disclosed, because the private litigators are going to have every incentive to push as hard as they can, to get as much information as they can, to test where the limits are. And there's a risk that mistakes are going to be made, combined with the fact that there are some cases in which we believe we can show to a high level of certainty that there's just no way that you can litigate this case to conclusion, and those are the, you know, hopefully rare cases in which we're going to say that we should decide it at the threshold.
Brief comments by Sharon.
Yeah, the brick wall metaphor reminds me, what if, you know, there were a criminal prosecution of a defendant and the prosecutor said, we've got this guy, you know, we've got so much evidence, there's no way any defense this person could raise is going to convince a jury. Why are we wasting time with this trial? We should just move straight to conviction. Now, I realize that may sound absurd, but the due process rights, the protections, we recognize that, and a lot of these cases do allege constitutional violations, that a brick wall isn't good enough. We need to still have that independent review by the court, and, you know, the downside risk here doesn't seem to me to outweigh those considerations just because you think it's fruitless. As, you know, Liza pointed out, if 1% of cases, we were going to come out the other way.
There is an independent review by the court. It's a question of when it occurs. It's not... The court's going to decide the question of whether this classified submission we made is sufficient to require that the case be shut down at some point. That decision is going to be made. The argument's a different one, right? The argument is, well, it should be made later because maybe you can develop evidence that would allow the case to be tried without having to confront that issue. And I'm saying, yeah, there are going to be some cases where that may be true. But if there are cases in which we can demonstrate very confidently and very powerfully that this just isn't one of those cases, and here's why, because at the very core of this case, the exact activity that the plaintiff is complaining about is an activity that we just cannot have a trial about. You know, that then those are the cases in which this is appropriate. And it's not about independent versus non-independent judiciary. It's about the timing of when that decision is made. And we recognize that it is important to allow cases to go through discovery when we think that we can. But what we're not willing to concede is that that is true in every case. And that's why we have the policy that we have.
Well, it's interesting. It really goes to what the state secrets privilege is. I mean, you've just heard a view that is very opposed to what Judge Hawkins said it was in the Jepson case. Judge Hawkins says the state secrets privilege, you know, does not exist so that the government can classify the truth or falsity of an allegation and therefore take the subject off limits for judicial scrutiny. The state secrets privilege is about preventing disclosure of information through litigation, and it shouldn't be used to prevent plaintiffs from making their case. And that's part of where our objection is here, which is, I also take your point, Liza, about, you know, which branch is most likely to leak classified information or least likely to leak it. There may be a handful of cases in which classified information has leaked out of courts, but they are dwarfed by the number of cases in which it leaks out of Congress and the executive branch and corporations and foreign governments. So, but at the end of the day, I don't think that the executive branch should be able to say to a court that plaintiffs should not be allowed to try to seek summary judgment on the basis of evidence that's already in their possession. If the government or a private defendant is blocked from asserting a valid and meritorious defense because of the state secrets privilege, then a case gets dismissed under the doctrine, and no one disputes that.
Okay,
go ahead.
Let me cut you off because I do want to get a couple more questions in. We'll take the questions from the three people currently standing at the microphones. Go ahead, Cal.
Hi, my name is Cal McClanahan. I'm with National Security Counselors. Most of the points I would have made, Sharon, have already made, and so I'm not going to rehash them. The one thing I wanted to suss out, though, was something that you said in your Mr. Verrilli, in your first presentation, in your speech, when you were talking about the reasons for the memo and the executive's position in setting up all the checks and balances and how everybody have to sign off on it, have to personally review it, you said this is so the high-level officials can be held personally accountable for whatever goes into these assertions. And my question is, how can you reconcile that statement that this will have them held accountable with the vehement argument that the AUSAs always make in these cases that the judge can't look beyond the affidavits to see whether or not it was a good decision to write the affidavit? Because it seems to me that if the judge isn't allowed to look into it to hold them accountable, who is holding them accountable?
judges are allowed to look into the affidavits and ask for more information, and they sometimes do, and we give it to them. So that just the premise isn't quite right. But beyond that, they're accountable politically, and the administration is accountable politically. This isn't a decision that you can say, well, this is just made by the career lawyers. This is the Attorney General of the United States personally on the line for this decision. And if it's a decision that in retrospect appears to have been one that was designed to cover up wrongdoing rather than legitimately protect national security, there's going to be political accountability, and that matters in our system. It's, you know, as I said, this is not a perfect substitute for judicial accountability. There's a cost. We get it. But there are other kinds of accountability, and we're trying to maximize them, and that's the reason for it.
Can I have a short follow-up?
Nope. Okay. Sorry, we don't have time. I'm going to be ruthless here.
Hello, my name is Latoya Lang, and I'm the Senior Research Assistant with the CGS, so thank you for speaking in our program today. My question is for Mr. Varelli. You have mentioned during your presentation that the litigation review report will be released soon. My question is, the process started February 9th. How come it's taken so long for the report to be released?
Because I'm not getting it done as fast as I should.
That's accountability.
Personal accountability.
I have a lot to do, and this is one of the important things I got to get done, and it's not done yet.
It's not because you're only working 40 hours a week.
Thank you.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, with all due respect, I think there's a lot of nice generalities, but we're missing the forest for the trees here. With regard to the question of upfront dismissals, I think Mr. Letter really let the cat out of the bag when he was trying to explain an answer in anticipation of Sharon's question. Namely, he said that, for example, Jepson might want to plead that it was an agent of government, but the fact that it was, if it was, a covert operation or a covert agent is secret. And then he, without using the exact words, essentially said, since it was covert, it's a state secret. No, it was covert and classified. It's only a state secret if, under ostensibly the new standard, there would be substantial harm to the government. And the only substantial harm is possibly saying, and this was used also in the surveillance case, that in the future people won't cooperate. Well, then you could say we can't have a litigation about a contractor hired to assassinate heads of NATO who won't bring enough troops into Afghanistan, because then in the future other contractors won't help. And what we know, as Sharon pointed out, stuff is terribly overclassified. I've looked at thousands of pages over 40 years. Rumsfeld has agreed. I don't know why Deputy Attorney General, in good faith, but perhaps recently a General Counsel, General Mills, or Secretary of Defense who came from Ford Motor, is in a better position to really assess the judgments, the predictive judgments made by someone at the CIA than a federal judge who quite likely was a former U.S. attorney. And the other thing I'd like you to comment on with regard to the bill, it's a little disingenuous to say that the administration's not taking a position. Anyone in this town for more than 6 months knows that that kills the bill when the Obama administration says it's not going to support it. And the people in the administration have acknowledged that to me. So I think the idea that we're sort of neutral and that's up to Congress is not really accurate.
So I didn't say it's up to Congress. I said we were engaged in a dialogue with Congress, which is true.
Well, I've been engaged in dialogues. Dialogue was essentially telling the Congress that the intelligence community doesn't think judges should second-guess them. That's what the White House told the Congress, which takes us back before Reynolds.
So here, I don't know exactly how to answer that. But I'm not exactly sure that it was a question. But I guess what I would say in response is we think that the decisions we've got to make in this area and a lot of other sensitive areas are very hard, and we are making them in good faith. Some of them you like. Some of them you don't like. I can do no more than assure you that we are wrestling with these with the utmost seriousness and doing the best we can to try to come to what we think is the right balance between the protecting national security on the one side and accountability and transparency on the other. We may not always get it right. We certainly won't always get it in the place that satisfies you, but boy, are we working hard to try to get it right.
Okay, well, thank you for the questions, and I thank the panel for this terrific discussion, and we'll look forward to further developments in the Obama administration's position.